Welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our weekly conversations include you. Tonight, you get to listen instead of making a call because we are recorded. We got a chance to sit down and speak with Ashley Merriman, and we'll tell you more about her in just a second. But consider this. What is it about the thought of competition that sets us off? We give every kid on the team a medal. We say everyone is a winner, although we really know there can only be one winner. Somehow, competition has gotten a bad name. And that's why journalist Ashley Merriman co-authored Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. She and writing partner Poe Bronson collaborated on the bestseller Nurture Shock. And in Top Dog, consider what it means to play to win. Ashley Merriman was recently in Honolulu, and we sat down to talk. So again, remember, we're recorded tonight, and the phone lines are unavailable. We began our conversation by looking at what it means to be competitive and whether competition deserves its negative reputation.
I don't think it is good or bad. It's how we respond to it. And there was this concern to be competitive must mean that you can stab your best friend in the back, that you may lie or cheat to get ahead, and that's what competition's about. And you know, anyone who says I'm competitive is saying I'm the next Bernie Madoff, and who wants that, right? But the research shows that none of that's true. Most of us compete. We do try and get the promotion. We do try and get that client. But we're not cheating. We're not backstabbing because we respect the other guy. And that's one of the really important things to know about competition. Competition isn't saying you're going to win every time. It's accepting that success takes a long time. It takes a long time to improve. In competition, you challenge yourself to work harder than you would have on your own.
So I mean, you're striving.
Absolutely. But it's also about expectation and anticipation. I can work out in my apartment and I have this used, beaten up elliptical that I picked up at a thrift shop. And I think, wow, I've had a really great workout. But it's not until I go to the gym that I really know what a workout is, right? Well, I don't go to the gym because I don't want to know. I'm quite happy doing my lame little workout in my apartment. So competition is about pushing yourself to a new level. It's about that improvement in the moment and over time. You know, we write in the book about Jason Lezak at the Beijing Olympics, and everybody focuses on this amazing come-from-behind victory he has in the last milliseconds of the relay. But for a moment, I want to think about earlier in the race. At the beginning of the race, 5 of the 8 teams were ahead of world record time. Every one of them was pushing themselves harder in the moment, looking at everyone else in the room saying, oh my gosh, I have to go to a new level no one thought was possible, even myself. That's what great competition is about. It's not about hurting other people. It's about respecting those people and having them inspire you to do more.
Isn't it also about knowing the context of all of this? Because just the story that you just told gives it a completely different spin and a different insight for all of us, knowing where people were coming into that, that there were 5 world records that could have been at that point. If you had stopped that race right then, what that would have said about the kind of competition. And in striving to be part of that competition, to say that you are going to do your best. We used to have that term personal best, and it sounds so icky poo to say personal best.
It sounds soft.
It does. It sounds like you're really trying to get to a better level, but you don't want to take responsibility for it.
Well, I think right now we're in that everybody needs to get a trophy mindset. And I think that's so hurtful for kids. And a bunch of different levels. One is, I think the idea is we're supposedly taking the pressure off. Everybody gets a trophy, so no one's going to feel left out. Well, first, let's just think about what this is for a moment. First of all, we're only worried about those kids at the bottom, right? That is only about the kid who would never have won a trophy legitimately, right? Because we're not really worried about the kids who would do really well in soccer. They would have gotten a trophy. They're doing really well. The middle kids, well, you know, they don't feel left out. They don't feel like outcasts. So does it work? Does it make those little kids who were struggling feel better? No. They know that they fell down when everybody else scored a goal. And to give them an award is just sort of confusing because they're thinking to themselves, why did I deserve this? It's pretty upsetting. The research says that, you know, toddlers, 2-year-old, 3-year-old, if you ask them who's the best reader in the world, I am. I'm the best reader. But by 4 and 5, even younger if you have siblings, kids know he's the best reader. He's the best athlete. He's the best singer or whatever. So the grown-ups pretending that everyone's the same ability just makes us look bad, not the kids.
And it sort of is that old adage about water seeking its lowest level when you're right. only pitching to the lowest common denominator so everybody can feel like they're just as rotten as everybody else.
Right. And it's really upsetting, actually, to those middle and high performers. The high performers feel tricked.
Yeah, why should they bother?
I worked really hard and I did really well and no one's recognizing that. I'm not going to make that mistake next time. I'm just going to barely show up like everybody else did because we all get trophies. And I also think, you know, again, that idea that we were taking the pressure off. But if you always have to get a trophy, isn't the message you always have to get a trophy? I think we're actually, rather than slowing down the pressure, we're ratcheting it up because we're giving kids the message that you must always come home a winner. You must always succeed. There's no room for screwing up and doing better the next time. And where is, you know, I've never heard a story of an Olympic athlete after they've been put, you know, the gold medal around their neck. But remember, even though you won the gold medal, it's not if you won or lost, it's how you played the game. We only say that to the losers. If you never lose, when do you hear that character was really what was more important than the result? Right now, it's always result, result, result. You must win. You must succeed. And we all know the research, interviews I've had with CEOs and Olympians, everybody always says, what I learned the most is when I failed. What I learned the most is when I made a mistake and said, wow, I've got to go home and try this again. Not, I've won every time and I'm perfectly successful. So I think it's really, really damaging that we have this fear of failure and that we need to rethink about what it is competition. It's not about success. It's not about winning. It's about improvement and pushing.
That idea that, you know, failure is not an option.
Right.
And there were many of us who were taught that. A lot of mixed messages. We saw backlashes of kids who had very, very liberal parents who became very, very conservative kids. And then it swung the other way. Well, pendulums happen. But the basic need to feel that you've done your best doesn't seem to go away. We just seem to be masking it by whatever is trendy or whatever happens to be the parenting way of being of the moment. Am I painting with too broad a brush here?
Well, I mean, obviously, these are general movements, so they're, you know, going to be people listening going, well, that's not my experience or that's not my kid. But the society does, I mean, there's research that says that narcissism is on the rise. Now, it's not universal, but Jean Twenge, I'm here in Hawaii to go to the American Psychological Association, and Jean Twenge, a professor at SDSU, was presenting research, and she's found that narcissism's been on the rise for about 20 years. And it's not that the majority of high school and college students have narcissism, but twice as many are at the top do have it. And what's considered sort of problematic is changing from the whole bell curve. People are feeling, I am special, I am wonderful, and you need to bow down to me. And in that way, you know, we're saying everyone gets a trophy and there's no competition, but there's always competition. Everyone is wonderful and we're supposed to accommodate that. And I think that's, a real disservice to kids.
Which sort of back ends into another conversation about, do we need to manage millennials differently than we would anybody else? People our own age or older than we are, or those who didn't have that way of being growing up. Do we need to manage them differently, or is that a disservice that we keep perpetuating because that's just the trendy talk for the moment?
You know, when I was writing about Carol Dweck's research about praise, and the effectiveness of praise, and that you shouldn't be telling kids, oh, you're so smart. Instead, you should say something like, oh, you worked so hard at this, because smart is not under your control, right? You can say it's parents or genes or background or a gift from God, but you're gifted or you're not. But working hard is under your control. And there are a lot of overpraised kids out there, kids who've heard, you're so smart, you're so special all the time.
Just because you're breathing.
Just because you're breathing, exactly. And, well, how did that, you know, what does an overpraised kid look like in high school? Well, their parents send them their teacher's emails. Your kid wasn't, my kid didn't get the right grade. My child's an A student. Or the kid themselves may say, I only get A's. And the high school teachers were telling me in secret off-the-record conversations, I can't handle the conversations and the dealing with the principal and the parents, so I just give them an A. And I know they're not going to deserve it, but they'll go to college. And, you know, in college,
it'll be somebody else's problem.
Well, in college, you know, it's real competition and they'll have to step it up. And then I had professors say, I got to have butts in the seat. If it gets out that I'm a tough grader, no one's going to show up to my grades and then I'm going to be fired. So I have to do some grade inflation. I can't be nearly as tough on them as I'd like. But, you know, after college is the real world and the real world's the real world. So everything will be fine. And then I heard stories about employers handing out Starbucks gift cards if you showed up to work on time. Not early, didn't do well, showed up to work on time. When I was in 2021, showing up for work on time was considered keeping your job, and late was you're fired. So I think there's a real tension right now in terms of, are we so desperate to keep young employees that we're going to be giving them rewards that they really don't deserve? I think right now with the economy and the job market that we need to give young people who are expecting the world laid down at their feet time to realize that it might be more demanding. You know, don't necessarily fire them but the first time they're late, but explain, no, you have to be on time now. And lay down those rules. And I think at some point, young people may be objecting to it, but ultimately it's going to be helpful to them. And to keep coddling them, to keep saying, oh, no, you're so wonderful, and if you don't want to work, that's fine. We'll all take it and cover for you. I think that at some point those kids are going to lose those jobs and there are going to be other people who want them. So I think we do need to be mindful of these expectations, but help get them off them.
Meanwhile, we have a lot of real jobs that have to get done. And we're told that, depending upon which way you want to believe the unemployment rate, that there still are a lot of people looking for jobs who are not in the millennial age group,
right,
and who really do know how to work well. If all of this is so, if we've been coddling this group to the exclusion of other groups and taking more work on ourselves so that we cover for millennials who somehow need it so that they stay employed, aren't we just aiding and abetting the whole collapse of building a real workforce that knows how to compete on a world level?
I think we might be. I think, although it's interesting, and this is a slightly different direction, but thinking about it in terms of globally, we all need to be careful. A researcher at the University of Michigan and in Israel looked at every SAT score taken, and they found that the more people who took the SAT at the same place at the same time, they're lower everyone's scores. Competition is personal. And it's knowing you studied for the SAT on vocabulary, so I'm going to have to really pick it up in my math section because I don't know as many English words as you do. And that the bigger we think about competition, it just becomes sort of overwhelming and too diffuse. I can't figure out how to compete against a Chinese kid that I've never met before and I don't know what he's studying or anything, so why should I even try? So I think if we think about generationally, it's hard to get that big picture and say, you know, well, can we compete globally? Because every time we need to say America needs to compete, it's not just us against the world now, it's, you know, us versus China and Japan and Singapore, and they're all going to kick our butts. People think that's supposed to be motivating, but it actually may be demotivating because it just gets overwhelming. So I think that there's a challenge when we're talking about these global movements. But yes, I do think, getting back to the millennials, that that's what I was saying in terms of, don't necessarily fire them the first time they screw up, but I don't think we need to change the workforce and the work environment to accommodate all of their needs. Instead, we need to say, well, if you have a different approach, let's see if it works for us, and if, or there's a reason we're doing it this way. And we can't let, especially millennials, but it's anybody who has like a fad. You know, hot desking is one of the new business fads. In fact, recently, the General Services Administration, the people in the federal government who figure out how many filing cabinets are needed, how many secretaries are needed, the GSA announced its headquarters are using a hot desking movement. Well, there's research that shows clearly hot desking doesn't work.
And for people who may not know what hot desking is,
hot desking is the idea that you don't actually have an office of your own. You may not have, you don't have a cubicle. You come in and you check in with someone and you pick up a laptop and you just sit anywhere. It's on a couch, could be in the bathroom, could be on the floor, and you're in different places every day. And the idea is, well, this is going to formulate innovation because different people will be talking and they won't be just hiding in their little cubicle farm. And cubicle farms are so impersonal. But the research finds that that sort of free-floating environment communicates that the company, the organization, isn't invested enough in you to give you a place to call your own. Yes, you may hate your cubicle, but it's your cubicle and you've decorated it and you say, this is my space. I'm going to go here and I'm going to have this. And they trust me to be the caregiver of this space. This is a statement to, and if it's an office, you know, the bigger the office, the bigger the company is saying, you're important to us, and we're giving you our prime real estate to let you do your work. And the research says that that's much more motivating. So we've got to be careful when these new fads come. Everyone wants to be innovative. Another one's Teams. We can talk about Teams if you want. But, you know, there's a buzzy, we need to change things, and changing things to innovation. So I think that goes with the millennial and, you know, oh, well, we need to change things because they are doing things and have different needs. Well, maybe telecommuting works. Maybe flexible work hours works, but maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're in an industry where everyone needs to know where things are and when things are going to be shipped.
Or to be in the same place at the same time so you can actually interact in ways that maybe you can't over a screen.
Absolutely.
But all of that said, you know, there have been so many movements that have come through business schools and different parts of, you know, the different sectors and industries. Because it's always good to move to innovation. Whether it's good or bad, the fact that you're moving looks good.
Yes.
You know, it gives at least the idea that somehow you're moving to progress. But in many cases,
CEOs releasing press releases that they're going to a team-based work environment.
Right.
They get bonuses. They get raises for having just made that press release that we're innovative forward thinkers. But there's no research that actually shows team-based performance is any better than individual performance.
And that's what I wanted to talk to you about now, because the idea that simply if you put it out there, it will be so, and you will have success, and all will be well, and you'll be the shining star, doesn't sync with reality in the same way that bending over backward to accommodate certain members of your team or just people who may be on your staff, that it doesn't lend itself to real success when you have the need for good collaborative work. Means too, you got to have some maturity to be able to understand some of this. So are we seeing an era where people are moving in some ways too fast, too quickly into high-powered areas of responsibility simply because they've had success in one particular area? And not exactly the Peter principle from, you know.
That was what I was thinking.
You know, years and years and years ago. You know, my mother's generation, we were, oh, that's a Peter principle. But looking really at what kind of real training do we need to give people as they are working with other people of all ages, and not allowing one group to dominate and sort of enforce its needs to the exclusion of everyone else's.
Well, Robert Hogan is a psychologist who specializes in workplace personalities. And he actually thinks most managers are bad. And what happens is that managers are focused on promotion, you know, trying to get themselves to do well. Well, a lot of managers, I'm not saying all managers are bad. This is Hogan's theory, that the majority might be, because the skills that they've gotten to promoted are about self-promotion, maybe even to the tearing someone down or ignoring someone else's needs and saying, I'm the person who did the lion's share of that project, even if it was something that was shared between a couple of us, and taking credit. So they do, they get promoted for this sort of self-aggrandizement, but none of that are skills to be a good manager, right? This, and they don't immediately flip a switch. Oh, now that I'm a manager, now that I'm a supervisor, I'm going to be generous and supportive and sharing and less concerned with my own needs. They say, well, I got here because I was focused on my own self. I was focused on promotion. I belittled some of my coworkers when necessary. So that made me successful then. Then that's what's going to make me successful now. So they continue and may even exacerbate those policies. So it's not necessarily the same as the Peter principle, but I think it does sometimes explain why some people get promoted when you look and go, what? Why him? When other people who are sort of quietly just doing quality work sometimes get ignored. So I think that that may be happening. I do think in the business world, people have identified a few key ideas as innovation. And like teamwork, if we use those buzzwords, right, in tech right now, the buzzword is disrupt. If you say something's disruptive, then, oh, that must be valuable, regardless of whether or not it needed to be disruptive or whether it was positive. So I think that that's an issue. But another one is collaboration. You know, the cousin of teamwork is collaboration. Competition, again, so last century. And one of the most famous examples in terms of how collaboration works is Wikipedia and a tech computer program known as Linux. And researchers have studied both Wikipedia and Linux and found that Wikipedia is a group of people coming together, but it's highly competitive. Because I make an edit to someone's essay and you don't agree with me, then you come and change it. And we go back and forth in terms of working this out. We don't get on the phone and draft something together. We're fighting for which version is approved, either between us or everyone else. It's so competitive that almost all Wikipedia editors are male, because women just don't want to get involved in all of the arguing. Linux is another one of those examples. It's supposed to be this worldwide example of software designers coming together to build this huge software program. And granted, it is. Most computers on Wall Street are using Linux. Amazon uses Linux. DARPA uses Linux. It's a huge program, and it exploded in about 10 years of development. But again, it's not about collaboration. 75% of the people who work on Linux are paid. They're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. Linux doesn't pay them, but Microsoft is one of the top 10 contributors for the most recent version of Linux. They get paid for using Linux, so they pay other people to help. And again, it's about whose code is better, yours or mine. We can argue about it, but ultimately somebody wins. It's a very public contest with lots of people coming to participate. But they're not working together. They're working to prove theirs is best. It is a competition.
So if we know this to be true, and we'll just accept it for a moment, it's a competition. We are competitive, even though we don't like to talk about it, in some terms. Not all terms, but in some terms.
Well, it goes back to what you're saying about context.
Right.
It's okay to be competitive at the Olympics, but maybe not at work. Definitely not at board games at home.
And there are gender differences that play into that, mm-hmm. too, and also whether one is an introvert or an extrovert. I mean, there's so many other variables. None of this is just a simple formula.
Right.
Still, there's the idea that we're doing great disservice to ourselves and really engaging in a lot of self-deception to say, oh, well, it's collaboration. Or, you know, and they put some nice word on it that makes it look like it's inclusive, when really it's just parallel play and a lot right. of infighting with that parallel play.
Yeah, absolutely. Competition has a bad reputation for creativity, you know, that the true artist isn't worried about things like competitors, money, status. But Michelangelo had an agent. and his contract for the Pieta. Yes, he had a contract for the Pieta. His agent negotiated it. And one of the contractual terms was that the Pieta would be the greatest sculpture in Rome ever. The Colosseum had already been there for hundreds of years. The Forum was there. Da Vinci was around. This was not a period when there was no competition. But it was in the contract that if his wasn't the best, he didn't get paid. And it was actually a standard term in Renaissance art where Perugino would say, my altar is better than his. And then the next guy would say, mine is better than his. And they would use specific artists' work to top it. And throughout the world, I bet you have bottled food and canned food in your closet at home or your pantry at home, right?
I guess that would be true.
Something, right? That is because Napoleon III needed to feed his troops. So he had a competition. The reason there's margarine is because Napoleon needed a butter substitute for the troops. So he had a competition. How am I going to feed the troops? Competition has actually been the driver of innovations and things that we use every day. Transcontinental flight. Lindbergh didn't fly because he wanted to. He flew because a Paris hotel owner wanted to increase tourism from the United States. That's why these contests are there. So to be saying that competition threatens creativity, I was at a presentation at the American Psychological Association convention the other day, and they were talking about the sciences finding that, you know, creativity is facilitated by constraints. Having everything is too big because you have to say, well, am I going to go to the right or the left? Is it going to be red or black? But if you're given a limit, like a contest rule, a deadline, now priorities start coming into play. Which is more important? What can I let pass by? And it pushes you to be more concrete, whereas you could just be walking around the beach all day saying, I should come up with some really great .com. But you never do it. If you do it, if you can't and you want that .com, look for a contest because they will have deadlines. And research has found, you know, in the biotech industry, Germany was having contests and 40% of their companies continued even after they'd lost the contest because it was such a concretizing experience that they said, yes, now we've got an idea, we can move forward. You don't even have to win. But you have to have that clear vision that sometimes competition provides you.
It provides the context for birthing the idea.
Exactly.
And when that happens, then you have to continue that same kind of process to get more ideas and more ideas. So if we know all this, why is it that competition still seems to get such a bad rap?
I really think, you know, as I was saying earlier in terms of that, you know, we have this idea that competition may be bad because it's about being duplicitous and dishonorable, and we don't want that. I also think it's also that, you know, since the 1980s, the self-esteem movement in terms of, you know, we need to tell everyone they're wonderful and support kids, that we're afraid of acknowledging competition because competition seems like it's saying one person is better than someone else. And then, you know, and don't want to get into an argument over political correctness being right or wrong. And it's about saying individual differences are okay. It's not saying one thing is better or worse than something else. We're saying everyone has different skills and abilities. But right now, I think we're afraid to acknowledge that. And rather than saying this person is a good athlete, I myself truthfully can barely walk across the floor without falling down. But I'm good at reading, I'm good at lecturing, I'm good at doing research. And I think that we just have that difficulty right now. And so the safe thing to do is to have an illusion of sameness.
Well, we see where safety has gotten us in terms of, you know, international rankings educationally. We've been dropping and dropping over the last several decades. Not coincidentally, the same time as we have the rise of this quote-unquote self-esteem movement where we're trying to make everybody feel good. The feel good and being good, there's a big gulf in there.
Yes, there's lots of research that American students have the highest belief in their math abilities, but they don't actually have good math abilities. There's study after study. They were just representing a new one over this past weekend that, yes, yet again, math kids said, oh, I'm really good at math. But when you gave them math problems, they couldn't solve them.
Tonight we're talking with journalist Ashley Merriman, co-author of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. And again, to make this conversation possible, we are recorded, so the phone lines are not open. Another issue that I want to talk to you about is empathy. Because tied to all of this, the being the best, once somebody really proves him or herself to be the best and begins to differentiate, there can also be a loss of empathy for people who might have been in the very same position as you back when you were striving. And that gulf begins to widen. The more one is affluent, the least likely one is to be empathic toward people who are not. And we've seen study after study after study. The most recent one was just a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. We keep seeing this stuff, Ashley. It's not like we don't have the empirical data to show us who we are. We've got these mirrors that are facing us and showing us, hey, it's not so hot. Why don't we stop believing some of the nonsense that we keep telling ourselves and look at reality?
Well, I actually think that's one of the times when I would say that competitions actually are helpful. And I'm talking about short-term contests because they do sort of challenge your belief. If you think you're the best surfer in Hawaii, but you've never actually met any other surfers, then you need to be in a contest to find out actually how you
rank. Or maybe an institution
rank.
For the delusional.
But I think that, you know, in some ways, you know, having that experience of being with other people is a good reminder then to, you know, wake up and smell the coffee. Hey, I can't necessarily take my abilities for granted. I need to keep improving on them and challenging myself.
But when you actually do get to a place of success and power,
right,
and the distance between you and everybody behind you starts to get wider and wider and wider, and you're not able to feel what's going on with that group or understand it, you know, that the problems of all the little people, and you used to be one.
Right.
Or maybe you weren't one and you were born into it, but somehow that disconnect plays into the fact that we've seen a middle class that's ever shrinking and the fact that we don't seem to know how to well integrate all of our skills and talents and weave them together in a way that makes us strong nationally and able to compete on the global scale.
Well, I think some of it is fear. The people around you, if you're truly powerful, aren't necessarily going to be wanting to challenge you in the same way that they wouldn't have had any problem with challenging you when you weren't all that, right? So respect and fear in terms of what the other people are doing and how they might respond to you. There are quintessential yes men. The research in adolescence, sort of that queen bee or all of the thing, the enforcer is always the second most popular girl, not the first most popular. The first most popular is already so popular she can sort of focus on being liked. She doesn't need to humiliate her peers. But the people who are up and coming, they're going to be the toughest, and they're the sharks. So I think once you have that moment when, you know, it's true success, it becomes isolating. You have less people who are challenging you, getting you to, you know, to calling you on the things that you have wrong. I also think at a certain point, we don't realize how much of an effect this has. One of the most astonishing studies I ever read was this. At first, I thought it was ridiculous. They had attractive college co-eds with clipboards asking people first to participate in a survey in a mall. The questions on the survey were actually irrelevant. The operation was whether or not you would agree to spend 2 minutes telling an attractive co-ed what it was that she was asking. But the manipulation was some of the girls had a plain polo shirt, and some of them had a teeny, teeny, tiny Tommy Hilfiger logo on the shirt. You were 70% more likely to stop and agree if you saw the Tommy Hilfiger logo. The girls themselves didn't even know the difference between the shirts. They didn't know there was a manipulation. But just that tiny suggestion of affluence might have been something. And then they sent other women in shirts with little Ralph Lauren logos door to door asking for donations to a heart charity. And they got 85% more money if they were wearing the designer logo shirt than the plain one. Just those suggestions of power change how people responded to them.
Why? Because birds of a feather want to flock together, or somehow it conveys that sense of affluence to me if I engage with you?
And I'm supposed to be respectful of people who are wealthy and have status. So I do. Even in ways that you and I aren't consciously aware of, that the bells and whistles of power have real influence. And I think they assure both the people who are around them and them themselves, well, I must be doing something right, otherwise I wouldn't have all this stuff. So there's a self-affirmation that's going on, and it's going to take some real strong character, whether it's parents or family or friends or someone who's gone up with the ranks with you, to be reminding you, no, this is a fluke, or yes, you're doing really well, but that doesn't mean you're perfect. But I think that's a lot of real challenge in character. And again, that was why I was saying contests may be sort of helpful, because you can't necessarily take for granted what you're doing. It was in the paper yesterday that Michael Phelps hadn't ruled out another Olympic run. He's the king of the Olympics. The only way to know is if he challenges himself. But is he going to expect he just wins every match 4 more years afterwards? You know, I don't know. That could be a real teardown. So I think it's that question. It's both the trappings of power become insulation to power on both ends, as well as the lack of the confrontation. You really, if you're a CEO or a manager, need to be very clear. You can always come in and tell me what you need. Tell me what the approvals are. Isaac Goetz, a French researcher who sort of does ethnographic studies of companies, said he went into one meeting and the CEO presented to all of the senior managers of this multinational conglomerate a new strategy they were doing and said at the end of the meeting, so, and no one has questions? Great to hear it. Never asked for questions, just instructed, no one has questions. Great. And everybody in the room felt that. Everybody understood. We don't challenge this guy. We don't give in our personal opinions or questions. We just toe whatever line he sets. So we got to be really careful about that in the environment.
That says a lot about the CEO.
Yes.
No matter who that CEO is.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you don't welcome questions, that presumes that you think everybody is either thinking the way that you think or should.
Right.
Or that you just are too busy for anybody to possibly have anything to say that might add to the discussion.
Right. The idea that someone else has a valuable opinion
Obviously
was not something on his radar screen, which was, of course, ridiculous.
But once upon a time, we were told that in building teams, the idea was to look for people who had very opposite perspectives so that people would see different sides of an issue, or not just sides, but almost like a parallax view. I see it from here, you see it from there. But as we start to see how these things draw together, we get a whole viewpoint of what it is we're really talking about and how we need to approach that problem. It also said something for self-esteem, real self-esteem, that it was okay to have a differing perspective and okay to voice it and have a meaningful discussion that wasn't based in, I'm right and you're wrong, but hey, I look at it a little differently.
Right. Well, the research is pretty clear that the best teams aren't made of team players, quote unquote. There's no scientific definition of what a team player is, but I think we all know, right? If you're told this job requires team players, someone who's not going to rock the boat, they're going to be, you know, carry the water when asked, they're not going to be particularly controversial, they'll be affable, everyone will get along fine. The research says that that's not a good team, because a team that's focused on maintaining harmony and everyone getting along forgets that they're there to do a job and to get something done. And, you know, we're not talking about personal attacks, but teams should have that feeling. Yes, we can argue. I've got a different approach here.
But of course, they have to actually show up to the job to be able to have those discussions. And if they're millennials, that may not happen.
But you also, sometimes the best team player is the guy who does argue. When a project goes poorly and everyone's just sort of glum and going, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. How are we going to do this? You need someone to say, hey, snap out of it and yell. You also need to think about it in terms of the time and pressure situation. It's really interesting. Harvard researchers went into companies and they were studying meetings. And in a low-pressure meeting, the person with the expertise held the floor. So maybe there's a junior account executive who's been working with this group of clients for a while, and he's memorized every fact, everything. And he says, well, these are what the clients that I've been seeing with really need, so this is what we should do. And they go, okay, great. And they follow that junior account recommendation. But in a high-pressure meeting, those people who have the specific knowledge become less important. And who becomes more important is the most important person in the room. And the most important person in the room says, well, normally our company does this in this situation. Or the general rule in the industry is we do this. And then everybody says, oh, then that's what we've got to do. So they forget the individual specialization and they go for those general rules that the most important person in the room says. But what the Harvard researchers also found was that most meetings are high-pressure meetings. Most meetings happen because there's an argument, because something went wrong and people have got to fix it, or there's a communication breakdown. So most of the time, people are actually leaving expertise on the table because they're afraid and they're going for what was comfortable and done in the past rather than that knowledge that they actually need to have in the moment.
So whatever happened to that idea that he who has the least to lose can say the most?
Well, there's actually two competing ideas. We even write about in the book that there's the Matthew effect and the Mark effect. You know, coming from the biblical, that the first shall be last and the last shall be first, or that he who's given much has much responsibility and he who has nothing will lose even what he has. And I think it's a constant balancing act in terms of, do we invest more? Do we give more to those people who do seem to be the early successes, the gangbusters, I'm going to go for it, and then not worry about those guys who are sort of behind because we're not going to be able to do anything with them? Or do we want the more level playing field so we don't invest more on those guys we think will be stars, but make sure everyone's got the tools that they need for success? And I think it's going to be a constant balancing act. I mean, in education for schools, I think we absolutely need to have a floor. All kids need to have at least this good an education or we're sunk. But beyond that, in terms of responsibility at work or something like that, then I think it's going to be more about what the industry itself needs. What do the people in that workplace want? Is this, you know, a life job and I spend 40 hours a day? And I said 40 hours a day. I used to be a lawyer. Working on it? Or is this more, this is a job that we want to do well and we want to succeed, but it's more important that I take the afternoon off to go to my kid's soccer game than make a meeting? So I think there it's going to be about those qualitative decisions, what's important to us. I don't think there's a right or wrong generally, but I think that we need to have that conversation and make sure that we're prioritizing in the way that's important to us.
Some of this would also mean that we need to look at what we mean by success. Dr. Paul Pearsall wrote several books, and several of them challenge the idea of what it is that we really mean when we say someone is successful. And is going to the meeting right now going to be as long-lasting as your kid's memory of not showing up to that lacrosse game or not being there to watch the dance recital? All of those things that become far more important for decades and decades and decades after the event when they're being carried by both parties in a very different way. It seems that we don't really have a full, rich idea of what success means, that we only define success by what your net worth is. And we kind of thought we got away from that a whole lot. But in listening to what we pay CEOs and how people are saying, well, how can a person be worth that much really? Have we just inflated this so high that now we just have to keep playing the same game? Or are we ever going to come back to a point of saying, we got to look at the real picture here and make some adjustments?
I don't think there is. I mean, the dictionary definition of success is someone who's achieved a certain level of accomplishment. And I'm okay with that. Now, what is accomplishment? I think that varies for each one of us. Someone is going to say, I want to be the best stay-at-home mom ever, and I'm going to be there for every one of my kids' games, and I'm going to be there when they need this, and we'll be the house where everybody comes after school and hangs out. And someone else say, I won a Nobel Prize for chemistry, and I'm going to never leave the lab until I get there, and I'm going to change the world because I've invented a new vaccine. Well, who am I to say either of those are the right definition of success? I don't think that that's true. I think the important thing actually is that we're getting confused, though. Is success, someone when I was at a lecture recently was saying that they had heard that to be successful was to be happy. And I thought that was really nice, and I completely disagreed. Because to me, I mean, I know people who work at the Gates Foundation, and they've saved millions of children's lives with vaccines, but they don't say, wow, I'm successful, I'm done. They think, oh my gosh, I should have saved more kids by now.
And there's so much more to do.
The Schindler's List, you know, I could have saved so many more. Success is about passion and driving yourself forward. It's not about saying, wow, I did something, I can, you know,
it's not
sit
an
in the porch and, you know, celebrate my accomplishments. And I think if you have that, it's a little disengaging. Success is about passion and fire. And what are you passionate about? And if you have something, it doesn't have to be work. It can be family. It can be a hobby. But it's that passion and using it to push yourself and be excited when you wake up in the morning.
So if we know that it's not an endpoint, and we've said that it's the journey, not the destination, all those, you know, little catchphrases we grew up hearing, yet though, encompassing all kinds of successes, you got to understand that you're not going to get them all at once. I mean, right. One of the greatest disservices that was done to generation, just about one generation ago, was telling us all that we all had to have it all. And if you didn't have it all, there was something wrong with you.
Right.
So have we gotten ourselves back to understanding that you can have some of what you want at one time in your life, and you may have other things that you want at another time, and that your success is being able to move from sort of one phase to the next phase fairly seamlessly as long as you're moving yourself to what moves you.
Back in the late 1970s, someone went up to one of the leaders of the feminist movement and said, you said we were going to have, that we were going to have it all. I'm a wreck. What's going on? And the response was, we didn't know it was this hard. I do think, actually, that the research indicates that the one thing the millennials seem to have best is that sense of proportionality, understanding what is important to them. If it's, I want a job where I can leave work, you know, to go on vacation or hang out with my friends because that's what's important to me, then that's okay. I think that that's actually probably the strength the millennials have right now is that ability to say, I can't have everything. I can't have it all at once. What's most important to me?
Just don't dupe the organization for which you go to work and promise to show up and be there. I mean,
right.
It's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Exactly. Well, I think you have to have some baseline of expectations which are reasonable, or you as a millennial say, I don't want the job that requires, you know, this. In the research we've found, you know, high performers are looking for high-performing, high-demanding jobs. You know, in the movie Glengarry Glen Ross, there's the famous sales contest. First prize, Cadillac. Second prize, steak knives. Third prize, you're fired. And everybody laughs. Oh, my God, who would want to work there? The guy who thinks he's going to win a Cadillac in a couple weeks. That's who wants to work there. High performers are actually looking for those opportunities to work themselves to death, to show you that they can make more, sell more, do more. That's exciting to them. So they're going to be millennials. They're going to be people of any generation who say, yes, that's the environment I want, where I can prove to myself and to others and to, you know, be a star and really shine. Other people are going to say, no, I am not interested in that. I want a job where everybody gets a set of steak knives and nobody's fired, nobody gets a car. So we, looking at this from the employer perspective, need to say, who do we want in our office? Do we want the guys who are all going to be fighting tooth and nail for the Cadillac? Or do we want a quieter environment, less competitive? No one's pushing themselves as hard, but it isn't as competitive. It isn't as fighting. And then we as the employees also need to say, which one of those do I want? Do I want something that's secure but not necessarily challenging? Or do I want that opportunity where I can really explode?
You're talking about a winnowing out process that happens internally and externally. So
right.
Those are going on simultaneously. If you have a match and it syncs, everything's great.
Absolutely.
In some cases, when you don't, then you have to, you know, keep making matches until you do. But there's also the overlay of biology. And what happens with the competition gene?
Well, you know, people, I think, have an idea that there's, you know, a gene for your hair color and a gene for height. There are almost 300,000 genes involved in how tall you are. 300,000. But there does seem to be one gene that actually is key in response to performance, to stress. That how are you going to do when the starter pistol goes off? When the manager says, come into my office now. And it's actually a gene. It's called COMT is the scientific parlance for it. What it does is it regulates the amount of dopamine in the prefrontal cortex of your brain. It doesn't even do so much for the other parts of the brain, like the ventral striatum, which is involved in reward processing. It's just the PFC. And the prefrontal cortex is, you know, about higher level thinking, planning, strategies, working memory, coming up with different solutions. And it turns out that there's actually different versions of the COMT gene. And depending on if you have one version that's fast-acting or slow-acting changes how quickly dopamine is recycled in the brain. Now, you want some, right? Because that's about engagement and focus and being excited. But you don't want too much. It'd be like flooding your car with gas. And what the researchers have found is that 50% of us have both a valine and a MET version. 25 of us have two of these valines. We call them vals. And 25% of us have METs, two METs. Now, the scientists call those METs the worriers, and the valines the warriors. The worriers, those METs, have on a day-to-day higher working memory, higher spatial abilities, higher recall, and they do really, really well in a class setting. But they're the ones who suddenly the big test, the SAT, the big presentation in front of the board suddenly become a puddle on the floor. They're overwhelmed by the stress. They've got too much dopamine going on in their brain. The vals, the warriors, on an average day actually have slightly less than optimal dopamine in their brains. They're just not as engaged. They're thinking, yeah, you know, I could do something or not, but just doesn't really feel right. And they actually need stress to perform their best because it pushes them and that dopamine increases with the stress to push them through that activity. But the important thing to know is that these METs, the warriors, aren't done. It's not that they can't compete, but they need to practice those particular stressors so that they have an ability to predict what's going on and a sudden stress doesn't become overwhelming. So the warrior pilots do really well as beginner pilots because they're not thrown by the storms and the altimeter and the pressure. Whereas the worriers, those METs, are thinking, oh, there's just so many dials, and if I screw up, I'm going to crash, and they become overwhelmed. But if with practice, the experts actually become even better. And so it's not that genes are destiny. There are actually warrior warriors in the U.S. SEALs, the Navy.
And you get $5 every time you can say that without stumbling.
But so it's not that genes are destiny, but they may help you explain why you need that stress. Why some people, you know, they just need drama. They need some excitement before they really feel engaged. Whereas other people who on an average day thought they were doing really well and became thrown. So for those people especially, you need to practice those abilities. I love to sing. And when I was a little kid, I would audition for musical theater. But I would get so nervous about auditions. I mean, I would just shake. I think you could hear my knees knocking louder than you could hear me sing. So I would only audition for the parts that I really wanted because the other ones were just too terrifying. And what I realized now is that was the absolute wrong approach. You need to do what the researchers call stress inoculation, exposing yourself to small stresses over time so it's not a big deal. As a kid, I should have been auditioning for the role of the 80-year-old man, even though I was an 8-year-old little girl, because I would never get it. So it was no big deal. There would be no expectation. So I could learn over time that that's what the stress of being judged is like. That's what the stress of you have to do this right now, even though you don't feel right.
And just to get the experience.
To get that stress experience. Absolutely.
And what about the 50% of us that seem to be fairly well balanced? I mean, you said, I mean,
lucky.
Well, but then again, that's half the population, which
it
means,
is, absolutely.
You know, the chances are you're going to run into someone who is not either a worrier nor a warrior, or
right.
a worrier warrior or a warrior warrior.
We're all of them all the time. In every office, you're going to have everybody.
Right. So how do you start to look at it from that perspective? And the reason I ask you is because we've had things like MBTI mm-hmm. that gives you a fairly good idea of where your personality falls. Has been used for years and years and based on Jungian psychology, on and further back than that. And now we're being asked to look at people a little differently about how we perform with stress, and knowing that stress will kill you and all the other things that
stress
your doctor will say.
Stress is not bad for you.
Stress is not bad for you. Depending upon how you have the stress and how inoculated you are with it or not. But how do we look at people differently now?
Well, chronic stress is bad for you. Chronic anger is bad for you.
Well, chronic anything, even eating chronic chocolate
exactly.
eating all the time
anything
would be bad
chronic
for you.
Is bad for you.
But I'll try it.
You're going to be brave. Thank you. But the acute, meaning those temporary spikes in anger, in stress, those are actually good for you. In fact, researchers have found people who are happy all the time and people who get really angry occasionally when it's warranted, those who get occasionally angry have higher well-being than those who say, I never get angry, I'm completely happy. Because they're responding to something. And the same goes for stress. Chronic stress, bad. But acute stress is about seeing that there's a challenge and you have to pick yourself up and push yourself through it. What I find fascinating is how little difference now I see between the physiology and the psychology of stress. The researchers have been at UC Berkeley and around the country have been talking about the difference between a challenge and a threat. In a challenge, you think you can do it. In a threat, oh, I don't know, I didn't study, I waited too long, I don't know how I can do this. Your expectation is you're going to fail. And in a threat state, it turns out that every one of the muscles lining your veins in your entire body contract. Your lungs get tighter. The way you process glucose changes. In a challenge state, the veins dilate. Your heart gets more of a heart rate variability. So your heart is pumping harder when you're running up a hill and easier when you're on a flat. And it's changing minute by minute. And these are not small differences. Researchers have found 2 liters more blood pumping out of your heart in a challenge state versus a threat state. So you can imagine if you're thinking, oh my gosh, I can't do this. I'm going to fail this test. I'm not going to get this job. That your brain is literally getting less oxygen to function on. Of course, you're not doing well. So the important thing is to focus on, it is a challenge. I can do this. It doesn't mean my outcome is guaranteed, but that I can focus on it and it's possible. If a threat is just thinking, oh my gosh, I have a bullseye on me and everyone's waiting for me to fail, and then your biology tenses up expecting that you're going to have the catastrophe and the goal is just to live through it. What you want to focus on is that option, that possibility for success.
May you have many more. Thanks so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you.
Ashley Merriman, co-author of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and that does it for us tonight for Town Square. I'll see you in the morning for The Conversation. Aloha.